please the court. We're here today presenting an argument on behalf of the city of Weslaco and its appeal of the denial of a plea to the jurisdiction. First off, we believe this is a case which requires the court to interpret Chapter 271.152 of the Texas Local Government Code as it relates to a ground lease agreement at the Mid Valley Airport in Weslaco. The appellee, Mr. De Leon, submits that he has a lease for one space, hangar, and then a sublease for another. And it's the city's position that the lease is not a contract within the meaning of 271.152, and that is entitled to immunity for the claims presented by Mr. De Leon for breach of contract.
I just want to interrupt real quickly. I know that there's a number of causes of action.
Yes.
If you look at the different pleadings, not only the breach of contract, but are there six others?
Yes, Your Honor, and quite honestly, I had intended to address primarily the breach of contract and the takings claims as appearing to be the primary claims that the plaintiff is making. Some of the others are ancillary, those are the issues that I'm primarily going to address, but obviously.
And in the judge's order denying, it was just one single line deny plea to the jurisdiction,
correct,
not with regards to each and every cause,
correct,
of action,
blanket,
correct?
And I believe that I did mention to the trial court judge that each one should be considered separately, but I think the order as it reads is just denial of the plea to the jurisdiction. So I'm intending to address the breach of contract claim and the takings claims primarily, and then any other issues that you'd like me specifically to address.
And one other thing to kind of clear this up, because it seems like it's been disputed. Did he buy the hangar, or did he not buy the hangar?
I believe
one says yes and the other says no.
I believe he's in, shall we call it, the process of buying the hangar. So Kane originally owned the hangar, I believe, in November of 20.
But without a ground lease, the hangar would be useless. Is that correct?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll let you proceed. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I just wanted.
No.
To...
Yeah.
And it was confusing.
And it's a very factually messy kind of case,
right,
because there's a lot of stuff going on here. So it's kind of difficult to grasp all the moving parts in this situation, and so. You know, at core, I guess he's saying, I have a lease, the city is disputing that he has a lease, and the judge in the trial court is denying our plea to the jurisdiction. So we're presenting the argument that this is not assuming he has a lease, as we must, for purposes of this appeal. We don't believe that immunity is waived for the claims that he's presented, because under the local government code, what you need to be able to show is that this is a contract for goods or services. And historically, traditionally, I mean, leases generally don't fall in that category. And in this case, it's a ground lease, so I guess he's pretty much entitled to access to the land. It's not, you know, property per se, I guess. But the contract itself doesn't meet the hallmarks of the things that have been held by the Texas Supreme Court to be services in all the court interpretations over the years. And you need to look at the contract. What does it say? Is it clear and in writing? Is it defined the services? Does it define the work that he's going to be doing? Does it define the services? State the essential terms. Is there an exchange of money? Or is there an exchange of something?
Well, that's usually for payment of services as well, correct? I mean,
typically, I mean,
I
that
pay
would
you
be,
to come clean my hangar.
Right, clean up the airport, mow the whole property, I don't know what, do something with the runway. I would think something like that would be a specific service provided. But in this instance, what the appellee, Mr. De Leon, is asserting as a service under the statute and under the contract is the fact that he might pull weeds or pick up trash or maintain the property. That is not the purpose of the lease. It's a common condition in most leases. I mean, tell people, hey, you know, take care of this place. You're going to rent it. You're going to lease it. You know, pick up after yourself. I have not found any cases that say upkeep of property is a service under the local government code. I think even in the Church in Aiken case, the Supreme Court decision, that actual argument was abandoned once it got to the Supreme Court level. And in this case, obvious, in our opinion, maintaining the property is not a central purpose. It's not even a purpose at all of this agreement. And that's why it's incidental. It's attenuated. And the city gets nothing in return. I don't believe that they could actually even obligate him to perform this portion of the contract or provide this particular service. I think the actual provision might even say that if he doesn't do it, they'll do it themselves, something along that lines. I believe the other service that they're asserting is provided by this contract is that there was a fire extinguisher put in the hangar. Again, not a primary purpose, certainly something that you would want to have at an airport in a hangar, but it's a fire code thing is what I believe is the situation there. So this is an incidental thing that he may or may not be providing. And we recognize that there has been chipping away of what is considered a service. It's becoming broader and broader. In recent years, you see these opinions that talk about building parking facilities. That was the Houston Community College case. Improving, rehabilitating, and maintaining a soccer field. That was the KLA case. And these are cases that are cited, I guess, in both of our briefs. But these were things that the tenant or the lessee did in exchange for use of the facilities. Hey, can I use the soccer field if I do this and this and this? We'll build a soccer, or we'll build a parking lot and pave it and do all this stuff for you if you let us have an easement. The cases, you know, generally are rather complex development projects where there's an agreement that the lessee do something or build something in exchange for something else. And that isn't this case. The benefit to the city of a fire extinguisher cleaning up the property, it's incidental. And
so what is the benefit to the city of having the hangar out there with this aircraft mechanic? Is it that something that can also be benefit to the city?
Well, the benefit of...
The big picture of the, not the individual provisions of the contract,
I think
the big picture.
Yeah, I think the big picture of having a number of lessees out there is to grow the airport, to have places for people, private persons or companies that might have an airplane that want to use this and their hangar to fly out of. It's not, and in fact, it is not supposed to be for purposes unless there is a separate contract of operating a commercial venture. Apparently, that's what Mr. De Leon ended up doing.
And there, my understanding was there was no contract for that, but I mean, is it undisputed that the city knew he was running a business?
Actually, they did not until... they did not until really all of this came up. That's when he was brought to the attention of the city. And I think even then in his testimony, that's when I was like, what? You know, he's operating this commercial enterprise out here. And so if he had had a separate contract to provide mechanic services or what have you to perhaps the city or to other people, that would be a different situation, but that's not what we have in this situation. And I think that when you talk about things like mowing the lawn or picking up the property or providing a fire extinguisher, I mean, you're really rendering the statute, you know, what does it mean? I mean, where do you draw the line? I mean, Mr. De Leon did not pay rent out there, but would paying rent, could that be considered a service? I mean, there's a payment exchange. Again, he didn't provide insurance that was required under the lease. But if he had, would that, I mean, where do you draw the line?
Right.
And when a party has no right under the contract to receive the services, the mere fact that there's some incidental thing like, oh, it might be nice if he mows the lawn, that doesn't, that's insufficient to invoke the waiver of immunity under the statute. The exceptions can't swallow the rule. I mean, the rule is that it has to be a contract for services. And while a service can be a lot of things, what is being suggested here and what is being argued here as services are simply not it. It seems to me that if this is what's considered services under the code, there won't be any contract for which immunity is not waived.
In relation to that as well, I know that the appellee is also making an assertion that you waived your right to appeal the breach of contract case because the injunction, is that right?
Right, yes, that was raised in their brief, and we filed a reply brief to that, and I think the situations are completely different. The injunction hearing
that's based on basically because the injunction says that one of the elements for the injunction is that there's a viable claim.
Well, right, that's what it says in the order, but that was not something that was argued at the time. I mean, at that point, we were actually saying there is no contract here. Immunity was not argued. When we actually did file the plea of the jurisdiction, no one said, oh, you've already ruled on this, so this is done. We're not here to talk about that anymore. The standards of appeal, I mean, you can actually appeal for the denial or granting of the injunction. And that would be a different standard of review. So we don't believe that there is any waiver that has occurred here with regard to presenting this argument. And so basically for all of those reasons, and primarily because I think then we're gonna have a statute that doesn't mean anything. If this can be a service to waive immunity, then there won't be any contract that isn't. And
well, some may decide that that's a good idea, Ms. Sandoval. Hmm? If the city enters into a contract, there should be no waiver. So there are some who actually believe that.
So anyway, with that, turning to the issue of takings, which when I look at this, it seems to me that it's more or less almost a recasting of the breach of contract claim, because his breach of contract claim is, hey, you refused us access to our hangar. And that claim, for the reasons I said, I believe is barred by immunity. So, well, let's put a constitutional label on it and call this a taking. But we do not believe that they have met the elements for a constitutional taking. Now, in the pleadings, in the latest amended petition, it says, well, this is an inverse condemnation claim. And I think in the brief, there is some allegation that it's a regulatory taking. So we have a unique situation here, obviously. It's not your typical, if we look at inverse condemnation claims. We're not talking about some homeowner who's been, boxed into their property by a bridge or road that's been built.
Now, there was, to me, in reading the briefs, there was some confusion as to whether or not he was allowed to go back. Does the injunction allow him to continue operating to this day?
Yes, Justice Tiadina.
Okay,
although
I think the city's position is that we've terminated, and so whenever
correct.
That injunction is resolved, then that issue will have to be determined as well, whether there's still a lease.
Correct.
So he's had access to it.
He's there now, and I believe that so when he was barred from going to the airport during the situation when there was the thefts at the airport, that was a temporary situation. Then sometime in May, to my understanding, is he was allowed back in, but he didn't like the parameters of I guess having to come during the day or having to, tell people he was there, that type of thing, I think. But it was really a brief period of time that he was limited from access to the airport. And it was for a valid reason. And to state or to make a case for an inverse condemnation claim, the elements are showing that the state intentionally performed acts that resulted in the taking of his property for public use. And the intent to cause harm is not there. I mean, this was basically a situation where we're trying to address a situation that we have on hand. So it wasn't intended to cause Mr. De Leon any harm or did we know that there was going to be caused any harm? It was just that the situation escalated when he chose to disregard the city's request that he remain off the property. Also, there's no public use that I'm aware of that's associated with this particular claim. I think they're saying economic development or airport development, but that element is not met. And I guess I'm up with my first 15 minutes,
Do you have any further questions?
I'll save the remainder of my comments.
Thank you, Ms. Aldabaugh.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm here representing Christopher DeLeon, DBA DeLeon Aircraft Maintenance Professional versus City of Weslaco. And we're here on the denial of the plea to the jurisdiction and amended plea of the jurisdiction filed by Appley DeLeon. As you probably know from the briefing, he's an aircraft mechanic. He holds a TSA badge. He holds a TWIC card. He's licensed by the FAA, and as respecting his credentials, he is allowed access to every airport in the country without limitation because of his clearance. He entered into a 5-year lease with the City of Weslaco for the use of the hangar, which was W6. He was purchasing, the ground underneath, he was purchasing the hangar from an individual named Harold Kane. And the bill of sale, I know there was a question about that, there's a bill of sale that's at appendix number 3 to our brief that shows the bill of sale from Harold Kane, and it was dated May 18th of 2018. And Ms. Conrad Sandoval has said, well, this doesn't meet the hallmarks of a contract. Well, the four elements of the contract are that they're that you have a contract in writing, the essential terms are stated, it provides goods or services to the government entity, and it's executed on behalf of the entity. And this issue of goods and services, if you take a look at Exhibit 4 in the lease agreement.
Ms. Klein, so is it your contention, though, that then he does own the hangar itself, which is, I guess, just to be considered personal property because it's...
Yes, but it's affixed to the realty, and that becomes important.
And it's not then Mr. Wise who owns the property?
Well, there was a second lease to a second sale to Mr. Wise who subleased to Mr. DeLeon. So he has the ownership interest in two respects. But the important thing that I would like to emphasize as it relates to the goods and services is that the city had said that he was, and it specifically stated, they stated the lessor deems it advantageous to itself, to the city, and to the operation of the airport to lease to lessee certain land hangar building offices stated. So they were leasing it to him because they were going to get a benefit from it. And on page 4 of it, it says that he agrees he
but
will...
But is a benefit the same thing as a service as defined in the code where it says it has to be a waiver? You only get waiver when it's at least for goods or services?
Page 4 defines what the services are. It says that he agrees he will at all times, not just when he's there, he will at all times keep the premises of the land hangar building office, including inside and outside of the hangar building office, clean and free of trash, litter, tall grass, weeds, junked automobiles, scrap airport parts, aircraft parts. So he had an obligation to clean the premises separate and apart from inside his hangar. So they were leasing it for economic development purposes, but they were contracting for a service. He was going to pay $900.
So here's the problem, and it's a twofold question. One, if we follow your train of thought as you speak now of it, Ms. Sandoval is correct. The exception that all contracts, basically, we are to generalize it this much as to what this contract says, then all contracts would really be a waiver of immunity because no one's going to enter a contract that doesn't have, as we've just discussed, a benefit to one or the other, to the city or to the county.
I would respectfully disagree to the extent that if you were to lease an apartment or you were to lease an office building, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to maintain the parking lot. That doesn't mean that you have to make sure the trash cans are there. It doesn't mean that if there's weeds, you have to pull them. You are obligated for your space. This obligated him to do other things. And the case law has tended to become more and more liberal. And Ms. Conrad Sandoval also mentioned the case involving the soccer fields, because it was determined in the City of McKinney versus KLA International Sports Management that a requirement to maintain soccer fields and improve the fields made it a contract for goods or services. That's not distinguishable from this case, that he was required to maintain the premises. And the city stipulated it was advantageous for them. The central disagreement I have with Ms. Sandoval is the fact that she's saying, well, this was not a service contract. And I right. think that's the confusion, because Birdson Services LLC in the Texas Supreme Court in 2016
said, it wasn't
said,
like Mr. DeLeon was providing any services to the city of Weslaco. This is not a, you're right. And I think that was going to be my second prong. This is not a service contract. This is not a contract where services is being provided to the city of Weslaco.
So the central question is whether or not, if there are services subsumed within the contract and required, does that meet the standard?
Right.
And Birdson, the Texas Supreme Court in 2016 said, 271 is written expansively to cover agreements providing services so long as services are provided. Kirby Lake Development took that further and said the services do not have to be the primary purpose of the agreement. If there are services, then immunity is waived. But as you've noticed, that's only one of the causes of action.
Yeah, but are you saying that, and is it Section E of the lease, I think, or Section 3, 4E, where it says that he'll at all times keep the premises, including inside and outside? Are you saying that he's supposed to clean the whole airport?
I think that it's clear that he was supposed to clean the area outside of his hangar, because if they're talking about junked vehicles, that's not his sidewalk. Junked vehicles are talking about trash. They're talking about an expansive area, including, in addition to junked vehicles, they're saying you can't have scrap airport parts. So he needed to make sure that all of that area was clean. So I think that clearly they part of their lease, I mean, $900 a month isn't a big ticket item for the city, but for that they were getting the promise that that area was going to be maintained and clean. And so the city didn't file their plea to the jurisdiction until October the 6th, and then they amended. But the most important thing I think here is that there was no evidentiary hearing on those issues that are in dispute. And the law is very clear that you must take the plaintiff's pleadings as true. And you must consider all the evidence in the favor of the non-movement. So that means that if there's not an evidentiary hearing contesting particular facts that we have raised, they are stuck with our pleading, because they did not put on a record to dispute that. And the failure to take an interlocutory appeal of the July 14 order, we still think, bars this argument. In the County of El Paso versus Napolis, they said, even if you have an amended plea to the jurisdiction, if that's just the same arguments and that's just the same evidence, which there was no new evidence, you revert back. You should have brought that up at the first time. But the other thing is that in the Munoz matter, if you know, Munoz was joined individually for ultra-virus acts, he didn't file a plea to the jurisdiction. So he's stuck in the district court because he has not raised the jurisdictional issue. And he didn't file a notice of appeal together with the city of Weslaco, even though he was joined and asserted jurisdiction, he did not bring an appeal. So we still have Mr. Munoz there for ultra-virus acts. They say that also he was required to provide fire extinguishers. But they say because there's not a contract, there's no damages. But we've established that he lost $100,000 in revenue. $100,000 in revenue because they locked him out of his own property. And on the constitutional issue, they gave him no notice of why he was being locked out. The record does not establish that he got any notice at all, whether that was verbal or written, and then they lock him out, and then they call the police, and then he gets arrested. He gets arrested for trespassing on his own property that at the time he had a valid lease for, and he had the interest in the hangar that he was paying for, and they had him arrested. So this man certainly suffered some damages, and the city also claims that the damage allegations don't confer jurisdiction, but the Romulus case says even if you're seeking attorney's fees, That constitutes damages that are sufficient to waive immunity. They are recoverable under contract, and that it is error to grant a plea to the jurisdiction on a request for attorney's fees, period. So the city cost him $100,000 in damages, and then he lost income because he couldn't maintain his equipment, and all of that is contained within our pleading. Second area, they say there is no takings claim. But the federal and state constitution provides that there's a prohibition against taking private property without compensation. Mr. De Leon had paid $35,000 for the hangar, which was subsequently appraised at $45,000. So he's locked out of this hangar. There were eight planes contained within the hangar that he had liens over that he couldn't remove. All the tools of his trade were in there, and he wasn't even told why. He made a complaint that someone else had stolen something from his hangar. Well, then that person made the same complaint. So they just locked him out. Under Shugart versus Thompson, which was a taking case, they said if you have an improvement to the land, which I think it's clearly that the hangar is an improvement to the land, that it's considered a part of the realty, and it was the building where he stored his property. And because there has been no evidence to show that it was not a part of the realty, he had a vested property right because he owned the hangar building and he had his tools of his trade, and that is why we've argued that it is a regulatory taking. It's a question of law that when a governmental entity deprives an owner of any economically viable use of the property or destroys the value or unreasonably interferes with the right to use the property, well, locking him out and having him arrested for stepping foot on the property clearly destroys the value of the property and interferes with his right to use his property. So it's clearly a regulatory taking, and U.S. versus Armstrong even says a governmental entity cannot destroy a lien interest that a person has in property. But they took his property for their use for economic development. And the constitutional claim waives immunity under the City of Elsa versus MAL. Now, all Ms. Sandoval says is, well, this is a recast of a breach of contract, but did not specifically tell you why it is not an impermissible, unconstitutional taking of his right to use his property when he's under a pending lease and he owns the hangar. Third, they say there's no
consent. Does it matter that he just leases and doesn't actually own the hangar? Because, I mean, there's that whole dispute of whether he actually owns it.
No, he was purchasing the hangar, leasing the real property. There was a bill of sale.
I thought he was more like, okay. I thought it was more like leasing in that leasing in the sense that you have the ability to enter into the premises, not actually own the premises.
But there's a bill of sale in your documents. It's exhibit number 3 that shows that he bought the property, he bought the hangar from Mr. Kane on May 18th of 2018. So the city says that there's no consent to the suit by statute, but remember that they stipulated in the contract, in the lease agreement at pages 9 and 10, that the parties irrevocably consent to jurisdiction. They stipulated jurisdiction was proper in the contract. So how in the world then can they come and say, well, there's no jurisdiction in the court?
Yeah, but I'm thinking this is the one, isn't that where if you read on, it says we submit to jurisdiction only if there's a valid claim.
Well, and that's an interesting thing too, because the court already found there was a valid claim by issuing a temporary injunction. You have to have a probable right to recover in order to get a temporary injunction. So it says, as long as one of the courts has subject matter jurisdiction and the parties hereby irrevocably consent to the jurisdiction of the same and of the appropriate appellate courts therefrom.
Yeah, but aren't we really there just saying that they're submitting to the jurisdiction, but not necessarily the subject matter jurisdiction of a particular claim?
Well, it says,
like if it was in fact a claim for goods and services, then it would fall underneath there. And we know you're making that argument, and we haven't decided that. But if it did, then it would fall. But if we said no goods and services, then there'd be no subject matter jurisdiction.
Except to the
fact
that
you gotta read them both at the same time.
Except to the extent that they say they have stipulated a subject matter jurisdiction, if you read it that way. But that does not take away from the constitutional takings argument regardless. I mean, the goods and services argument is the only one that you heard any significant argument about. They say that the declaratory judgment doesn't waive sovereign immunity, but they had demanded possession and threatened him with a forcible entry and detainer, and there's a claim for attorney's fees. So now, what's really making all
so
this...
So is that the balance due to the local government entity under the contract? Because there can't be any waiver unless there's recoverable damages.
They have refused to accept his payments. So he was never in default, but they have refused to accept his payments, if I understand your question. Under the Nazari case, if the governmental entity seeks affirmative relief, they waive sovereign immunity. And they have a pleading on file where they are asserting breach of contract, trespass, declaratory judgment, that he be ordered to vacate the airport, seeking attorney's fees, and seeking to participate in a forcible entry and detainer. So even if...
So that's just to get them off, that's like an eviction, just to get them off the premises. Does that really create a recoverable damage, though, that would waive immunity?
Absolutely, because there's cases that say even if, under Riata Construction, if the governmental entity seeks affirmative relief, the trial court obtains subject matter jurisdiction over the claims. And they filed affirmative claims on September 30th before they filed their plea to the jurisdiction. Under the Nazari case, it says if a governmental entity seeks affirmative relief, the city waives sovereign immunity. And under Wasson Interest versus Jacksonville, they say if they're engaging in a proprietary function, then they waive immunity. And this is a proprietary function because they're leasing land and they're doing economic development. That's not the planning part of it. That's the generating revenue part. So clearly they're engaging in proprietary activities and they sought affirmative relief. The statute does not waive sovereign, they claim that the statute doesn't waive sovereign immunity for declaratory judgments, but there's no case law that says that. They also are now arguing that Munoz was acting within his authority, but there was no evidentiary hearing on that. So you're stuck with the pleadings as a matter of law that he was acting in an ultra-virus capacity. So because the pleadings are being taken as true, Munoz is still before the court because he didn't file an appeal. So are we going to try the whole case just as to Mr. Munoz on the ultra-virus? I mean, it's rather odd. The sixth point that we made in our briefing is that we have also asserted specific performance, and specific performance is not excluded from the doctrine of waiver of sovereign immunity. Houston Community College versus HVBTW says the legislature did not exclude specific performance as a cause of action that can be brought against a governmental entity. So between the constitutional claims and the specific performance and the declaratory judgment and the fact that they brought affirmative relief, even if the court has trouble with this contract providing services, and again, I mentioned to you that the case law says, especially Kirby Lake Development, it doesn't have to be the primary purpose. It can just be incidental. So even if you have trouble with goods and services, you still have a constitutional claim, you still have a declaratory judgment, you still have the specific performance claim, and clearly damages have been wrought against my client who got arrested when he has a TSA badge that allows him to be on any airport property. And there is no evidence that he got any notice as to constitutionally, any due process as to what did he do? What in the world did this man do? They never even put it into their notice. What they put in their notice ultimately in their amended answer in July 30th of 2020 is the first time we got a hint of why they locked him out. They said, you failed to comply with airport rules, whatever that means. They never even told him what rule he supposedly violated. They said that you're operating a commercial enterprise, don't know what they're talking about, and that they failed to provide commercial insurance, which apparently they never said, hey, by the way, do you have insurance? I mean, to say that he can go to all the trouble to outfit this place and do his work and invest all this money and have all these planes there and then have them come in and say, no, we're going to just terminate your lease and we're not going to tell you why and we're going to keep all your stuff and we're not going to let you do any work. And then when you turn around and complain about it, we're going to say, oops, we're immune. That's what the city of West Laco is asking you to find. And we ask that you, to the contrary, affirm the denial of the plea to the jurisdiction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Fleisch.
Not sure quite where to begin after listening to all that.
Where would you like to begin, Ms. Underwall?
Well, I guess that I did want to finish the discussion about the takings and the exclusion of Mr. DeLeon from the airport. And I think that this needs to be put in context. In a takings analysis, you focus on the character of the act, the character of the action and the nature and the extent of the interference. Mr. DeLeon, despite his TSA badge, whether he's a lessee, a sub-lessee, a tenant, whatever he is, he didn't have absolute access to go wherever he wants, whenever he wants, on the airport, and that's what seems to be what's suggested here. There is not only a lease in place, there is also the rules and regulations that govern the functioning of the airport. The lease says you need to comply with these rules and regulations. The rules and regulations say that the city has the right to limit or restrict access. So what happened here is we've got a situation where Mr. DeLeon and his, putting it in context, we've got a report of thefts. We've got DeLeon and his next door hangar neighbor pointing fingers at each other in the thick of things. The police are investigating, and under the airport rules and regulations, he was validly, temporarily restricted from access, as was the hangar neighbor, Remy. The airport has the right to exclude. It wasn't unreasonable in this context, and it wasn't applied only to him. This is an airport subject to federal regulations, subject to the rules and regulations of the airport itself. Mr. DeLeon knew about them. So the reason for this restriction and limiting his access after a period of time was valid, it was important, and it was uniformly applied. So we don't believe it was an improper use of the city's rights under the lease or as an airport operator. They were acting within their scope, and this is not an unreasonable interference with his access given the context. Under the circumstances, it wasn't unreasonable for what occurred to have occurred. And so that's why we don't believe that it was a taking. I just wanted to briefly, some of the points that Ms. Klein pointed out. You all were trial lawyers. I mean, when we were getting ready to go to trial every other month with this situation, yes, we filed some responses, including, hey, well, if they're saying this and we're gonna go to trial next week, well, then we want you to rule the opposite. We did not make any affirmative claims for monetary relief. And I think that's what the cases talk about. Rayada, there were no affirmative claims for monetary relief. And so I cited a bunch of cases in the brief that talk about the fact that just because we filed this declaratory judgment in response, it was defensive to what was being thrown in our face at the time when we're basically a week out of trial.
And the deck action is actually the only claim that you're making, isn't it? Other than the JP forcible entry.
And that was before, I think that's what prompted, I guess, should I say, the TRO was when it was a letter was sent to them telling him that he had violated the exclusion order. So for Mr. DeLeon to be suggesting, oh, I didn't know what was going on, why aren't I in here? I mean, he knew exactly what was going on, and he knew what the complaints were. He knew he was not supposed to be on the premises. And he went on there anyway, and that's what caused the situation. It escalated, etc., and here we are today. And so I understand there's a lot of moving parts with this case and that there are a lot of causes of action pled, and we did request the court to look at each situation specifically, each cause of action that was pled. We have a blanket order denying the plea to jurisdiction. We're asking this court to reverse and render and find that there is no subject matter jurisdiction over the claims being presented. Thank you. Unless there's no other questions.
I don't think so. I think we have it.
Okay, thank you.
The case will be under submission, and the court stands in recess for today.